I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's Friday. That means the news roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. And joining us this week, Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor at WCAI. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mindy.
And joining us on the phone, Philip Martin, senior reporter at WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Philip.
Yeah, hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good. So, Philip,
hey, how are you?
James Whitey Bulger convicted on Monday in federal court in Boston on 11 killings and other gangland crimes. You were covering the trial. Tell us a little bit about the verdict and, you know, the reaction.
Well, I think that when the verdict started coming in, when the jury filed in and they started reading the verdict, I think you can imagine that there were a lot of gasps.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you heard a lot of gasps is because they started running down the acts of murder, it was not proven until you got to number seven. It was extraordinary because it seemed initially that the government had lost this big time. It seemed initially that the defense argument linking the government to all types of acts of malfeasance and collusion with mobsters had won the day, because it was charge after charge was coming out not proven. And then, of course, the murder charges themselves started piling up. And then, with the exception of Deborah Davis, when they got to Deborah Davis, there was another gasp when it was decided that it was no finding in the killing of Deborah Davis, allegedly by Bulger. And it seemed, in talking to jurors, it seems that this happened, in retrospect, it seems what happened is that the role of Steve the Rifleman Flemmy, one of Bulger's associates, his main associate, it seemed that there was concern that he may have actually carried out the murder rather than James Bulger, that he strangled Deborah Davis in the view of the jurors. And that's why you had a no finding in that case. One reason, Mindy, that is so important is because, if you know, Whitey Bulger built his reputation on three items, if you will. One, he did not import drugs into South Boston. That was totally blown away during the trial. Number two, he did not kill women. And, of course, that's why the no finding in the death of Deborah Davis was important to him. And number three, and most important, is he was not an informant. Now, the trial seemed to suggest throughout that he was indeed an informant. As far as Deborah Davis, it was proven that he killed Deborah Hussey, another woman. So all three myths in this case have been essentially obliterated by the jury verdict.
Yeah. What was his reaction? Did he react at all, Whitey Bulger?
Yeah, he did. He not in a way that I would say he reacted, when you compare it to the way he reacted throughout this trial, there was indeed a reaction. There was a pulse. He was sort of blinking his eyes when the no finding came in. That was probably the only reaction you saw from Whitey Bulger, and that was subtle, obviously.
Right.
But throughout the trial, he's basically looked down, except for the few moments when he used the F word to describe a few colleagues and replied to a few colleagues. But for the most part, throughout this trial, he's looked down at his notepad. He's been taking notes furiously. It's speculated that he will be writing a book. But he was taking notes throughout. He ignored most of the witnesses, with the exception, as I alluded to, Kevin Weeks, whom he got into a verbal tug of war earlier in the trial, with the F word figuring prominently.
Yeah. What was Deborah Davis's family's reaction?
Steve Davis was torn up. Steve Davis has represented the family. That's her younger brother. He has represented the family at the trial throughout, and even before, when he sat in at other trials, civil suits against the Bulgers. And he said this. This is interesting, Mindy. He was torn up that it was a no finding. But at the same time, he said, look, he was asked point blank, do you think that Steve Flemmy killed your sister? He said, yes. I believe Stephen Flemmy killed my sister. He had a motivation for killing my sister. He was jealous. He was, in fact, not jealous, crazy jealous, maniacal, homicidal, in Steve Davis's view, jealous. And so he believed that even though Whitey Bulger played a role in killing his sister, He believed the actual murder was carried out by Steve, the rifleman, Flimmy, who had a sexual relationship with Deborah Davis, who treated her to all types of flights around the world. And during one of those flights, she went to Mexico, fell in love with a Mexican fella. And we know Flimmy and Bulger had tapped her phone, so they found out about this. And so what Flimmy started saying was that she might go to the police, that she was inform on us. But the real reason, jurors believe, and the defense argued, was that he was just crazy, mad, jealous of the love interest that Deborah Davis now had, and then conspired to kill her. And Steve Davis believed he did kill her. Killed her with his bare hands. Mm-hmm. He believes that she was strangled by Stephen Flimmy, not James Whitey Bulger.
Philip, James Whitey Bulger's lawyer has indicated that they'll appeal, and one of the issues is this immunity to prosecution defense that they weren't allowed to present at trial. How do you think that's going to go forward?
I think they might have a point there in terms of how the in terms of the basis for the appeal. It's believed that Jeremiah Sullivan, the former U.S. attorney in Massachusetts, that he in fact extended immunity to Whitey Bulger. That's the argument, and that they were not allowed to argue immunity at this trial. As a result, the witness list for the defense was cut from about 60 or 70 witnesses to 14. The defense believes that by cutting their witness list to 14, that Whitey Bulger did not, he may have received a fair trial, but it wasn't, could have been fairer in their view. That immunity, they believe, should have been allowed in this case. Now, it's an incredible argument, really, because you have the defense arguing that Jeremiah Sullivan extended immunity to James Whitey Bulger. So what does that suggest? That he could carry out murders as he saw fit? It certainly suggested that he could carry out extortion and other acts of racketeering as he saw fit. He was definitely given that permission by John Connolly, the disgraced FBI agent now serving 40 years in a Florida prison because of his role in the death of John Callahan, the businessman in Florida. But to suggest that he was allowed, that he would have been allowed to kill with impunity is extraordinary.
Yeah, it is extraordinary.
But at the same time, the immunity defense could, in fact, play a role in a successful appeal if they can show that the government did, in fact, collude beyond beyond the assumptions of merely involvement in extortion, racketeering, and loan sharking, and that it did extend to turning a blind eye to the acts of murder committed by Whitey Bulger, because in their view, at least the view of John Connolly, of John Morris, the other FBI agent who was disgraced, and Paul Rico, another FBI agent who was disgraced, in their view, these were just other hooligans who they were killing,
right,
without taking into account that these killings also included several innocent people, if we were to look at that word innocence in its in all its logic. Deborah Davis, Deborah Hussey, Michael Donahue, the man who gave a ride to a fellow named Brian Halloran one night on the waterfront and ended up being sprayed by bullets.
Yeah, wrong place at the wrong time, exactly.
What about, there's a few other states that are looking to put James Whitey Bulger on trial, and these are death penalty states. Any indication yet from the governor's office about whether they'll send Whitey off to another state for a different trial?
It's a really good question. It's a good question, Sean. Put it this way: Oklahoma really wants him. Oklahoma, where a fellow named Roger Whitaker, who owned a highlight company, a World Highline company, was murdered sitting as he was getting in his car by hitman John Monterano. Monterano, of course, has been given immunity. He has been he was a prosecution witness. He killed 20 people, served 12 years and 2 months as a result of that killing. And the state of Oklahoma, however, wants to try Whitey Bulger for that killing because they believe he was involved, that he conspired to kill Roger Wheeler, and so I think as far as whether or not the governor will allow this, it's not clear. Mm-hmm. It's not clear. Right now, Whitey Bulger will be sentenced to, he'll never get out of prison, obviously. The sentencing is November. He'll get multiple life sentences. And I think philosophically, Patrick might oppose it because he opposes the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, Philip, is Whitey's brother, William Bulger, did not attend any of these court proceedings, right? He sort of kept a low profile throughout this?
He did. And it's speculated that he kept a low profile as a result of, as suggested by his brother, Whitey Bulger, because it's believed that if he had been in the court as the other brother was, Jackie Bulger, that the spotlight would have been focused on him and whatever legacy he has left as Speaker of the House, so on and so forth, that basically would be obliterated.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, the Senate, as the head of the Senate, my apologies. That reputation would be obliterated by his presence and his closeness to Whitey Bulger, that a lot of questions would basically have been focused on William Bulger, and it felt that Whitey Bulger would felt that would have been a disservice to his brother.
Yeah. And then, Sean, we had one of the jurors, juror number 12, I think, was a Cape Cod resident.
Right. She's Janet Ollier-Tinney. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. She's from Eastham. And, you know, she had a pretty interesting conversation with Patrick Cassidy, the reporter that wrote the story for us. And, you know, she talked about how, you know, she was familiar with Whitey Bulger's name and sort of knew that he was a scary monster. But she said some things that were really interesting. I think it was the thing that she said that she was struck most by was the fact that, sure, you know, Whitey was a terrible, you know, or as she put it, a bad, bad man. But she said that she was stunned by the corruption in the government that it took to get Whitey Bulger in the courtroom. And so she was really blown away by that. Mm-hmm. And then she had some, you know, sort of interesting things to say about some of the players in the trial. She said that the jurors loved the judge, that the jurors thought the judge did a fabulous job. They also liked Whitey Bulger's defense attorney, Hank Brennan. They mm-hmm. thought that he did a pretty good job of basically keeping them awake. I guess he was sort of entertaining in some ways. But she also said that that she personally had a severe, or she, as she put it, I intensely disliked Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Kelly. She said, personally, because of the way he treated some of FBI agent Robert Fitzpatrick and Kevin O'Neill, who's this bar owner who had collected money for Bulger. She basically said that she felt like that he vilified both of those, but treated FBI agent John Morris, who admitted to taking bribes and so forth, with all this deference. And so she felt really strongly about the prosecution. And then, of course, she went on to say that they felt like the prosecution didn't prove all of the cases in terms of the murder. But she, you know, she made it a point to say that it wasn't a not guilty. It was what was the finding?
No finding in the Deborah Davis one.
Or no, there was another term that was used on it, and it's not for not guilty on some of the other things he was acquitted on.
Not proven.
Yeah. And she was keen to point out that in her mind and as well as other jurors, that not proven doesn't mean innocent.
Right.
Doesn't mean
right.
that we thought he wasn't involved in any way. Not proven means exactly that just we thought that the prosecution didn't do exactly the best job in presenting some of the evidence.
Yeah. All right. Philip Martin, senior reporter at WGBH. Thanks so much for filling us in on what happened in the courtroom. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mindy.
Sure.
And Cape Cod Times, the article was an excellent article, by the way, pointing out also the fact that this woman is a writer. Right. I'm wondering if a book is going to come out of this.
She didn't say that.
I think she writes history, but we never know. All right. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Point. It's the news roundup with Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times, and Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor at WCAI. Last week, we learned of the State Ethics Commission ruling that basically gave Senator Dan Wolf the choice of leaving politics or cutting ties with his company, Cape Air. And this week, he made clear his decision to challenge that ruling and what he plans to do going forward.
That's right. He said that he's still in it to win it. In fact, the day that he came into the newspaper last week, and I was able to sit in and listen and ask some questions, talking to some of the editorial board staff as well as a couple of reporters. And, you know, he was adamant and about wanting to stay in the race as a governor, and talked about how he felt really blindsided by this ethics ruling, primarily because he had disclosed his relationship to Cape Air when he first was elected going into the state Senate back in 2010. He served for now 3 years and is sort of wondering. So as I raised a question in the column that I wrote about this is, you know, why would it take 3.5 years for them to rule on something that this office that was disclosed to this office year after year for 3 years? And, you know, in terms of and also the woman, Karen Nober, who is the head of the Ethics Commission or the executive director of the Ethics Commission, had before coming to the Ethics Commission had served as the deputy chief legal counsel at Massport. So it does make you sort of wonder. So if the former one of the head lawyers at Massport now works for the Ethics Commission, you have a state senator who has ties to the airport and has disclosed that. You know, why would it take 3.5 years for this to come up? Now, the Ethics Commission says, well, you know, there was this out of an abundance of caution, as Senator Dan Wolf had put it back in March, you know, when he was considering running for governor, he, you know, filed this paperwork and asked for an opinion from them. But then August 2nd, their opinion came out and hit the news that, well, our opinion is that there's a conflict of interest. And so what people need to know is that what this whole conflict of interest thing is about is Massport, who owns and operates Logan International Airport, has these contracts, if you will, and that's sort of a term of dispute, I guess, but these contracts with all of the carriers that go there, you know, to access the gates and landing, you know, to be able to land there and so forth. There's these fees and rents. And you know, Dan Wolf's point is, yes, but those fees and rents and that contract, if you will, Dan Wolf says it's not a contract, it's an agreement. The reason why he says it's an agreement and not a contract is because there is no negotiation. Right. The fees and rents are set by the federal government. So his argument is that the state conflict of interest law, that this is sort of outside of the spirit of the law. It's sort of an overly broad interpretation, you know, because the idea is, you know, when you have these no bid contracts, the idea being if, you know, if you're, say, a construction company or something like that and you're doing some work on behalf of the state, he's saying that this is fundamentally different, that this is, you know,
and they give it to everybody.
They give it to everybody. Yeah. There's no opportunity to influence. And so he thought, going back to, you know, even when he first run, that, you know, particularly because of his familiarity with the way airports run, that it was so obvious that the thought hadn't crossed his mind that was a conflict. And then, of course, serving for 3 years and nobody says anything, you could see why that was sort of reaffirmed. Now, in retrospect, he says he wished he would have hired a lawyer, you know, from the very beginning back in 2010 to you know, to really pursue this to the nth degree. You know, unfortunately, it's too late now. And so now there's this ethics ruling. And one of his main complaints is that between March, when he filed the paperwork with the Ethics Commission asking for them to look at this again, and August 2nd, when they issued their ruling, he said that he was contacted, or his office, not even him directly, was contacted just to confirm that his ownership in the stake of Cape Air was about 20%. One of his complaints is about the process. He said, they never gave me an opportunity to respond. I had no idea that this was an issue until the ruling. And he said it would have been nice for me to be able to respond and say, well, at least here's my side of the story. Before you make a final vote, maybe you can take that into consideration. And now what's happened is now he has this ethics cloud, you know, hanging over his head at the very time that he's trying to raise money for his gubernatorial campaign. So unwittingly or not, the State Ethics Commission has really, you know, put themselves in gubernatorial politics in this regard. And so it's kind of a problem for State Senator Dan Wolf. But he says he's going to move forward anyhow.
Sean, was this an administrative decision that then can be appealed to the full ethics board, or has the full ethics board already voted on this? What's the process for an appeal?
Yeah, no, I'm not familiar with the sort of the intimate details of the process. Yeah. As I understand it, the full board did vote on this.
I see.
But there is an appeals process, and that, in fact, he's sort of begun. Their next meeting is September 19th. He's hoping, of course, to expedite that process and get it done before. One thing that was interesting, he said that he hadn't actually filed a legal challenge yet through the courts, and in fact, may not do that. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason he said is because to him, that's sort of the politics as usual, lawyering up and all of that kind of stuff. And he said, you know, if the Ethics Commission doesn't in and of itself change their mind, then I really am going to have to make a decision about whether or not I'm going to divest completely from Cape Wind. Cape Air. Or, you know, try to set up some kind of like blind trust, these kind of things. But he hasn't really crossed that bridge yet because he's really holding out hope that the Ethics Commission is going to change their mind.
Yeah. And I think he's, and, you know, this could actually help him.
Help
his campaign.
We've made that point. I mean, he's very business oriented. He's not well known off of Cape Cod,
right,
though he's certainly well known here, mm-hmm, as you know, the former president of Cape Air, mm-hmm, and very active in all sorts of nonprofits. That's well right. known here, but when he gets out there and is on the front page of the papers, who is this guy? What's he up to? There's a possibility his name could be more well known and be known as that business guy who fiscally conservative, socially more progressive, mm-hmm, is the way he's viewed, and so that might help his campaign. So did we hear that he has said, look, if I'm elected, I'll give it up. I'll give up.
I personally asked him that, put that question to him, and he threw out two options on the table. He said, well, there's the most extreme option would be to completely divest. The other option, he says, which I'm not sure about, is this whole blind trust thing, and he's sort of skeptical that that would necessarily work. Hmm. But he said specifically that to him, being the governor, or being a governor is such an important thing. He said he even thinks, you know, it could change the world. It was, mm-hmm, the language that he used, that he would actually do that if that's what he felt like, or if he determined that that was absolutely necessary for him. To become the governor, mm-hmm, he would divest from Cape Air if push came to shove, and which is a pretty strong statement.
Right.
But he's not going to make that decision, of course, until I think he gets a better sense of how things are going to move forward.
Right.
I mean, certainly,
and if the Ethics Commission may change their mind, they may.
That's right. And we also asked him, you know, about whether or not he thought there was a sort of silver lining in the sense that now that there's sort of all this press about, you know, him being a businessman, that if he can get past this, it sort of introduces him as a businessman and sort of,
right,
you know,
state, yeah,
makes a point. But he said, but the problem is that with this ethics ruling, he goes, that's not the way you want to be introduced, because
right, sure,
every
sure.
place off Cape that doesn't know Dan Wolf's record, his history, there's different interactions with the community, the first thing that's going to come to mind is, oh, you're that businessman with the ethics thing over
right,
his head. And
yeah,
that's not really the way he wanted to introduce
of
himself to voters.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, more to come on this. Camp Richard on Nantucket, where the Boy Scouts have been camping since the 1950s, is at the center of a dispute over who owns the property.
Yeah, this is a interesting case. So the Camp Richards is this 100-acre parcel of undeveloped land on Nantucket, where in the Boy Scouts there have operated there since the 1950s, and they also manage the camp.
Mm-hmm.
But also they are a part of the Cape and Islands, of course, Council of the Boy Scouts of America. And so recently they, and they've been managing and putting money into the camp, over the years. And recently... the Cape and Islands Boy Scouts decided that they wanted to sell a part of that land, 30 acres, for about $3 million. Now, the folks on Nantucket were saying, well, wait a minute. This is our land. You can't just up and, you know, especially since we've been the ones taking care of it. And so they're in court now basically fighting. I mean, the Cape and Islands Boy Scout Council is sort of making a legal argument and saying that, well, they don't really have deed to the land. And I think the Nantucket folks are sort of making, well, they're making a legal argument as well, but they're also sort of making a moral argument in a sense and saying, now, this just isn't right. We've had this camp for a half a century. We've been operating it and managing it. And now here comes the Cape and Islands larger council. They want to sell it without our knowledge, mm-hmm, and all of a sudden change what we have had here for so long. And so now they're in court trying to, basically hash this out. And in fact, the judge that's presiding over this case, I think it's Judge Gary Nickerson.
Yeah,
yes,
it is. Mm-hmm.
And he basically wants them to see if they can kind of come to some solution, you know, outside of court. And in fact, gave him until, I think, today to do that. I think today, this afternoon, if they haven't come to some kind of agreement, then it's going to move forward. And so
it's a kind of an interesting case. And this land was given to them, deeded to them to be a camp, right?
Yeah, it was the Nantucket Civic League that had deeded them this land back in 1955 to use as a Boy Scout camp. And then in 1973, the district created this nonprofit Camp Richards, Camp Richard Campers Association to run it. Mm-hmm. And since then, you know, the district has, like I said, has invested all this time and money into the property. Meanwhile, the Cape and Islands, council is sort of asserting their regional authority and saying, yeah, well, we'd like to sell it, you know, for the greater good, I guess, of the Boy Scouts on the Cape.
I'm also wondering, too, if maybe there isn't some legal precedent here in the intent of what that land was given to be used for.
Right.
You know?
And
I mean, that may play.
And right. And to be continued, because it doesn't, from what I understand sort of about the two parties, they don't strike me as being sort of close to a solution, at least by 2 o'clock today. But we'll see.
We'll find out. All right. A ruling against a solar panel permit in Yarmouth caught many by surprise.
Well, that's because this is the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District, and so they have this plan to install these roof and these ground-mounted solar arrays on school properties in both Dennis and Yarmouth. And in fact, I think the plan was going to basically eliminate a lot of the, you know, costly and rising utility bills for the school district. And they had gotten the approvals from the various boards in both Dennis and Yarmouth until they went to the Yarmouth Zoning Board of Appeals, who they needed a special permit to do this project. And the Yarmouth Board of Appeals basically rejected it for public safety concerns, essentially. I think some of the concerns that they threw out were things like, well, we're not sure that these things, because so much of the project is going to be ground mounted, we're not so sure that these things are properly secured and that, you know, I don't know, that kids could go over there and climb on them and fall and hurt themselves and who, I don't know, liability, that they might vandalize. Yeah. You know,
it sounds like you have a problem with the ruling.
I guess.
You have trouble understanding.
I guess
it.
My columnist colors are coming out right. of it here in this conversation. But at any rate, the fact of the matter is, aside from what anybody thinks about it, is that they did indeed reject it for, you know, those various reasons. And, you know, the superintendent of the school district, of course, was stunned.
Yeah. Mm.
And particularly since, you know, here's a town where they've had a lot of contentious battles over the budget of the school. And sort of the mandate for the school district has been time and time again to cut. And they've tried to do that. They've done all various things. They've even closed, they've shuttered various buildings. And now here they come with this plan, solar panel plan, and, you know, to cut down a huge expense. And the Yarmouth Zoning Board of Appeals says, well, no, we don't like it because kids could play on it. And by the way, we might be able to see it from one of the roads as you drive by.
Yeah. It's interesting. You kind of wonder what, you know, if there's more to this story than what we're hearing, because you got everybody else approving it in town. And then, as you said, the school superintendent being really surprised by this, the school superintendent who's supporting it. And obviously, if she was concerned about kids getting hurt on this, she wouldn't be supporting it.
It is a surprise. Cape Cod talks a lot about renewable energy. I mean, it's probably one of the top five discussions right next to wastewater up here. And we've talked a lot about wind power, and that has been chilled. That industry on the Cape has been chilled by what's happened in Falmouth, with the neighbors complaining about the land-based wind turbines here, in addition to the overarching discussion about Cape Wind, the proposal to put 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound, which has been controversial. Solar has been really the bright
taken
light,
off,
so to speak, here on the Cape. And so to have this large project, a lot of communities are considering large solar projects, Mashpee being one of them. There's a solar project at Four Seas, the Cape Cod Community College. So, yes, this is a surprise. And you wonder what is behind it. I'm sure this will come back to the zoning board.
I was going to say, obviously they're going to appeal this, right?
Well, I think they're sort of in let's figure out what we're going to do mode.
Yeah.
But
right.
I would be shocked, that if they wouldn't. I mean, especially when you're talking about the kind of money money that they could be saving in a district that's really struggling, not only financially, but also trying to retain students. And one of the things that the superintendent pointed out is that in addition to the savings, they had hoped to sort of use this as a way to introduce young people to this, you know, sort of emerging renewable energy industry where, you know, you presumably, and as there already are, you know, there's some well-paying jobs and some economic growth to be had in this area. And, you know, as Sean mentioned, it is sort of stunning that, you know, as municipalities and districts move to try to find ways to reduce skyrocketing utility costs, which they don't have any real control over, that everywhere they turn, there's this huge pushback. And then when you have an instance like this where the reasons being given are because of, you know, worried that kids are going to vandalize, you know, solar panels, or that they're or that you might be able to see them from one of the roads. Feels a little bit disconnected to me from the larger concerns that, you know, communities have. But
well, and mentioning wind power, Falmouth Selectmen are looking at wind mitigation funding.
That's right. Well, so this, of course, is coming on the heels of the town meeting vote, where they had this big vote about whether or not they were going to take down these two controversial wind turbines that have, you know, really negatively impacted some of the neighbors that live in and around those areas. Now, it was, you know, the estimated cost to take these down were somewhere between $12 and $15 million. So the selectmen put it on up to vote, to town meeting vote, and it was. And the selectmen, by the way, have come around to the neighbor the neighbors who want these things taken down. The selectmen have essentially coalesced around that and said, yeah, that's what we should do. So they put this vote to the voters in Falmouth, but the Falmouth voters said, oh no. Let's not take these down, A, and B, let's certainly not take them down at that cost. And so now the town is in this process of figuring out what to do next. And so that's what they're in that's what this is about. So at their Monday meeting, the selectmen got this 16-page report from the town manager, Julian Susso, you know, kind of sort of laying out what some of the options. And so the board voted 4-1, basically, to have the town manager drop these options for what they call mitigation funding, you know, basically under the assumption that these two turbines are going to operate at about 76%, you know, combined capacity each day. And he's estimating that that would generate about $1.6 million to $3.8 million in revenue between 2015 and 2025. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot of money to me. And I think part of the idea is they want to have this they used up the money, essentially, that would be used to fix these turbines should something happen. Mm. And I think some of this money they want to be able to sort of build that pot back up again, because one of the concerns is that the longer these things, and that these things weren't designed to be shut, you know, to flip the on and off switch constantly. And you know, as anybody knows, when you're using a product in a way that it wasn't designed for, you can end up having mechanical troubles, which then could make these things even more expensive. And so, you know, they're complex machinery, as the town manager pointed out. And so right now they're just beginning what I believe will be probably somewhat of a slow and painstaking process to sort of figure out, okay, the voters don't want us to take them down, but we do want to mitigate the concerns that some of these neighbors have expressed. So they're really trying to do this delicate dance where they're respecting the will of the majority of the town voters, but they're also heeding the concerns of those who live by the turbines. I wouldn't want to be in their shoes, honestly. Yeah. It's a dicey
situation.
I don't
think they know quite the path forward. Yeah. They're not certain. There's folks talking about buying out properties where the people living there say they're affected, their health is affected by these turbines. That's what they say. But the selectmen have pointed out over and over again, where do you draw the line? Mm-hmm. Who do you buy out? Who do you don't? Right. How many homes do you buy out? How far away from the turbines can they be? Mm-hmm. And when does that start and when does that end? Mm-hmm. It is a real quandary.
Well, the other question we have going back to town meeting is that the price. You have all kinds of estimates. I don't think, you know, had a real handle on exactly what that figure
to get
really,
rid of,
yeah,
to take
what
them
that
down.
Figure is.
Well, the selectmen said that they were very confident in their figure, which was about, I believe, $14 million. But advocates for the turbines themselves had a much higher number, mm-hmm. between $20 and $25 million. So there were a lot of numbers being thrown around out there. Does it include the money that you're going to lose by not having them operate? Right. Is this just taking them down? Are you going to sell those parts? Mm-hmm. Are you going to just scrap the entire thing? Can you sell? I mean, there were a lot of questions in a fairly short amount of time before that vote. When people really started to pay attention, there were a lot of questions and a lot of information to kind of get out in a short amount of time.
It's the News Roundup. We're talking about the region's top stories of the week with Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times, and Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor at WCAI. Well, a telephone survey by Entergy Corp, which owns Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, finds at least half of the year-round residents on the Cape would flee if there was an incident at the power station. Not a surprise. The question is, how?
Right.
They're going to close the bridges so the Plymouth folks can get out.
Right. Because you talk about the Plymouth folks, because that was really sort of at the bottom of this, which was that the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency and then the Barnstable County Regional Emergency Planning Committee, along with this KLD Engineering, who Entergy hired to do the survey, they really wanted to know, particularly because the emergency radius is this 10-mile radius around the Pilgrim plant, which is basically around Plymouth. So the current evacuation plan basically sort of assumes that traffic from the Cape won't come into play if folks should have to evacuate from the Plymouth area. The survey suggests, well, that's probably a horrible assumption because, mm-hmm. surprise, surprise, if there's some kind of nuclear incident, you know, whether or not this is due to the ignorance of nuclear physics or whatever you want to say, the fact of the matter is that if somebody tells people that, hey, there was some kind of nuclear incident, release of radiation of some sort maybe at the Pilgrim plant, that a lot of people on Cape Cod are, you know, who are downwind essentially, you know, 40 miles as the crow flies or so, are going to, you know,
try to get out of here.
Trying to get out of Dodge. And in fact, you know, the way the questions were a little bit vague in terms of what exactly the incident would be, but I think something like 70% said that if they were in the emergency radius, which hasn't been expanded to the Cape, that they would evacuate. But even if they weren't, that they would still, about half of the folks who responded to the survey said that they would leave. That would create a huge problem for the folks in Plymouth trying to evacuate. But for us here on Cape, even more importantly, and I think most of us knew this because we've seen or been in traffic on, in a non-emergency evacuation, if you will, situation. And to see traffic backed up to, you know, exit 6 or something like that. And
a 4th of July weekend, 25-mile backup.
You know, sitting in that parking lot for hours on end, I think if you add the element of, oh, my God, there's nuclear radiation coming towards me.
Craziness.
I'm pretty sure that the only way to leave the Cape would be by plane, train, or not train, by plane or boat or hook by crook, whatever, swimming.
I think they need to expand that, you know, have some emergency planning, even if it doesn't involve, you know, the Pilgrim folks. Get the, you know, I mean, we've got ferries here. You know, that would seem like a more logical way to get a good number
together.
Of people off. Yeah.
Well, this zone, it's an arbitrary zone. It's a zone that's established for nuclear power plants. And when Fukushima happened over in Japan, they expanded that zone very quickly to 50 miles because obviously these particles wouldn't be stopping at 10 miles. And opponents of the plant have lots of concerns, all centered around what happened if there was some sort of emergency. Of course, there's the evacuation, and no one thinks you can get people off Cape Cod, and so they haven't planned for that. And also monitoring where the particles would be going, the radioactivity, where would it be going? There are monitors on site, but so far, despite a real big push by opponents of the plant, there are not monitors at locations in other communities around the Plymouth nuclear reactor. Yeah. So you wouldn't, in a live situation, you might not know even where exactly the radioactivity is going. There are lots of concerns here. And then we hear more concerns. I'm sure you're moving on to
this
other story.
On the heels of this survey, we have a Department of Defense Commission report citing Pilgrim as being one of 8 plants that are vulnerable to an attack from the water.
Well, one of the reasons it's vulnerable is because it has its cooling pool where they put the spent fuel rods basically up near the roof of the reactor. It's above the reactor, and essentially what is considered a roof-engineered pretty much to the equivalent of a high school gymnasium roof. Mm-hmm. So a plane goes into that, you've got a problem. You also have the fact that it's right on the water. Mm-hmm. Now, military installations that are right on the water have been required to install barriers to prevent a seaborne attack. Well, civilian facilities such as Pilgrim have not. Mm-hmm. So boats, and there have been boats that have been stopped because they've gone too close to the reactor. That is the concern. What type of problem could you cause for that reactor if you get a boat up there quickly enough? And how can they react if there are no barriers to a fast-moving attack, a terrorist attack?
Yeah, so we're vulnerable to an attack, and we have no escape route.
And we have no escape route, yeah. I mean, it's not exactly...
not cheery news.
Not exactly encouraging. Of course, you know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who, by the way, is criticized in this report that you're talking about here for not requiring these various security measures to be implemented, they say... Well, yeah, we already knew that stuff, so no new information here.
Right, we already talked about this.
Yeah, we already talked about this, and we relicensed them anyway, so let's move on. You know, the Carol Whiteman, who's a spokesperson for Entergy Nuclear, who owns Pilgrim there, she said that, you know, that they have a very robust security plan up there, of course. And although Alan Kupperman, who was one of the lead authors on this study, this Pentagon study that looked at these things, said that, yeah, there have been some upgrades and those are commendable, but not nearly enough. And then he said, you know, he also said you have to wonder whether or not they have, the, you know, the resources to pay for these really expensive sort of security measures. And then said that, you know, it's the government's responsibility to sort of fill the gap. Now, you know, it's easy to say, but in an environment of, you know, austerity and budget cuts and so on and so forth, you know, it's not exactly an easy proposal to float, particularly when you've got so many people who are upset about the, you know, the subsidies in renewable energy and the subsidies in any, you know, there's sort of this knee-jerk argument that there shouldn't be any subsidies. And so if the government is going to step in and, you know, and pay for this on top of some of the, you know, some of the economic problems that some of these nuclear facilities, I mean, it's a Pandora's box. Yeah. It's a mess. Mm-hmm. And for us, of course, the real Pandora's box is we better hope that there isn't an attack or any kind of release, because, you know, if there were, you know, unless you've got a bomb shelter here or something like that, you know, some KI pills, then, I guess it's sort of a luck of which way the wind is blowing.
Yeah.
Well, you can certainly be a supporter of nuclear power and still have these concerns.
Sure.
You don't have to separate the two. You can be concerned. And you can like the fact that it's essentially emissions-free power, though some people would argue it does give off a slight amount of radioactivity, and that it has a large place in our grid, a necessary place in our grid, so you don't want to necessarily shut it down. People have that view.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you don't address
the evacuation
issue in case something does
happen. It's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, they should expand that. And I think part of the reason maybe they haven't expanded that 10-mile radius or whatever is because it's how do you plan that? We're in a really odd kind of position here with you know, the Cape and the islands, for that matter. You know, it's crazy. All right, we have the weekly shark update now. We finally have a shark tagged by the O-Search team. I was wondering if they were seeing them. That was the crazy thing. They could see them, but they just, for some reason, weren't able to catch any of them.
Right. And then a picture's worth 1,000 words. I don't know if you saw the picture
in the paper of the guy
sort of taking a nap on the couch. You know, and I can imagine it's tedious out there waiting, because, I mean, it's not as if they can control the sharks, although I'm sure they'd love to. But, you know, good news, I guess, that they finally did tag a shark, because for a couple of weeks there, or up until then, it had been a whole bunch of false starts, so to speak. What I thought was interesting about the Doug Fraser story this week was sort of the description of what they actually do to try to entice these sharks to get close enough for them to tag them. They, you know, they've got this 5-gallon bucket, and they, you know, they mix it in with this barrel of fish heads, and then they bring the seawater in and they dump it out behind it, and they create this fish oil slick, essentially, you know, this sort of fish oil slick with the chum, so to speak, and hoping that the sharks will be attracted to it and that will be their bait. But unfortunately, in the past couple of weeks, at least for these researchers, the sharks have been around, but they've said, yeah, we're not interested in that. And so
we've got seals over here.
Yeah, we've got, right. So, you know, why do we, it's almost like, why go for the energy drink when we've got, you know, Old Country Buffet or whatever, you know, off of Monomoy there. So it's been interesting to sort of see how they've done this. I thought it was also interesting that one of the leaders of this expedition, Chris Fisher, you know, who's done this successfully in, you know, in South Africa and in some other places, sort of acknowledged that, you know what, maybe I sort of overestimated the success that I've had in the past and didn't really consider that, you know, not all sharks, particularly the ones in the Cape, apparently, you know, don't really prefer their particular brand of chum.
Right. And was it they're out, what, 30? Is it 30 or 31 days that they're out there? They're trying to, yeah, a month anyway.
I thought it was a month. Yeah.
Right. And there's a couple weeks left on their permit to be in state waters, which they're hopeful that, you know, now that they've got this tag shark, that there'll be a few more to come along. And then they've also haven't ruled out the possibility of maybe asking for that permit to extend
and
a bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, then Greg Skomal on board there trying to learn as much as we can about the great white sharks, which, you know, we are seeing more of in our waters, but maybe not as many as we thought, right? But they're taking these sharks out for 15 minutes. They're not, you know, and they're putting.
Are they doing an ultrasound?
Right. It's kind of like a, you know, a pit crew, as Doug explained it, where they do it really fast because they're trying to take live blood and tissue samples, of course. They try to do this ultrasound real quick to see if the shark is pregnant. And then actually one particular researcher wants to attack this special sort of, speedometer, essentially, mm-hmm. to basically figure out how fast the sharks are moving, whether, you know, what direction they're spinning in or lifting up out of the water, all these kind of things. They're trying to get these real detailed 3D pictures to really understand, because even though, you know, it seems like we pay a lot of attention to sharks and there's all these shows on sharks, in a scientific way, not a lot is understood about some of their mysterious behavior, including mating and some what they kind of do off camera. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're interested
that's
to
what
find,
we're
out.
Find out. Yep. And they put little cloths over their eyes so they calm them down a little
bit. Sure, I'm sure that's very calming. Yeah.
I can't see what's going on.
Poke and prod and cut. Yeah.
We got a call from somebody who wanted to clarify something we said about the Falmouth turbines. Falmouth voters did not say they didn't want to take down the turbines. They said they didn't want to take down the turbines at the cost of $14
million. An important point, and that is exactly correct.
Right,
yes.
Thank you. A 10-year-old girl found a message in a bottle, but this message, part of some scientific research that's been afloat for over four decades. How exciting for that 10-year-old
girl. That's a cute story.
Yeah. I like the story. I mean, you know, it's not one of these message in a bottle like a romance thing where there's some love note and those things can be fine, but in this case, it was a part of a scientific, it's really a remnant of a scientific project out of St. Andrews Biological Station up in New Brunswick in Canada. So this was a letter from the Fisheries and Oceans Canada office, and it was initially dispatched about 16 miles south of Maine way back in 1969. I guess it wasn't that far back, although a couple years before I was born, so over 40 years ago.
I was in eighth grade.
That's the measure we're using when Sean was born.
That's right. So BSG. This was BSG before Sean Gonsalves was born. And the note basically asked the finder to send, and what the experiment was about was really to try to study the way currents operate.
We've come a long way.
We've come and the reward was that was a dollar.
Yeah.
You know, maybe back in 69, what would a dollar get you back in 1969?
I don't know. Ask Mindy.
The penny candy store still had penny candies.
Right. So she did, but what was really cool about this is that, so the note instructed whoever found it to get in touch with the folks up in Canada, which they did. And
she wants her dollar.
What was more surprising is that they actually heard back and they explained what this experiment was about. Unfortunately, we've kind of come a long way in technology. They use mostly satellites now to figure out current stuff now. And as our story noted, no word on where that dollar is.
Yeah, you could also get into the movies
from Canada.
Dollar,
it might cost more than a dollar to send that dollar, but they should send it to her.
They should send it to her. And I thought it was interesting too that they were able to determine the fact that this bottle probably spent some time under the sediment and things, because they said the sunlight would have, you know, faded the message.
Oh, if it had been bobbing in the ocean for 40 some years.
Yeah, so I mean, that's sort of interesting in itself as well. All right, Kettleers, league champs.
They are the league champs. They beat Orleans 6-1.
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting what Orleans' name now, and since the Major League Baseball, which drives me insane, had to change their name.
I don't remember either. We've got the paper over there.
I'm sorry, Orleans, that I can't remember the Redbirds? No.
Firebirds.
Firebirds. There we go.
Redbirds. Right. I was close. So Kituat, yay. Kituat wins. Yeah. Apparently it was an exciting game. I haven't been able to get out to see a Cape League game this year.
Well, they'll be
That's
back again next summer.
They will.
Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor at WCAI. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Philip Martin, senior reporter at WGBH in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.